Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for December's Neurology Club webinar. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker for today, RCVS and European Specialist in Veterinary Neurology, Tom Cardy. Thank you, Tom. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thanks, Daisy. Good afternoon to those of you watching live, and good afternoon to those of you who will be watching a recording of this. Today's presentation is a brief insight, the best I can do in an hour, on performing the neurological examination. As Daisy said, please feel free to post any questions. I'm happy to answer them as I go along or at the end of the presentation. So let's get cracking. I guess neurology is potentially perceived to be one of the most complex and challenging subjects that we practice both in a referral setting and a first opinion setting. But actually, with a little bit of practice, and if you keep things simple and use a logical approach, potentially it's one of the more easy disciplines when you're confronted by those challenging patients. Now, I try and make sure that I myself and members of our team, we always try and answer three key questions in each patient that presents to us. The first of these is the dog or cat neurologically normal or abnormal? Fairly simple question to start with. Then we try and make sure that we ask ourselves, is the issue likely to be brain? Is the problem localized in the spinal cord or the neuromuscular system? So far we got neurologically normal or abnormal, and then brain, spinal cord, and neuromuscular system. And I think most of us can get some, we can get pretty close on those two questions with every consult. And in terms of making treatment decisions and referral decisions, that's a good start. The final bit is a bit more complex and challenging, and that's where we're trying to determine a precise neuroanatomical localization. So we're going to go through those in a little bit more detail and put them into practice. So neurologically normal or abnormal, it's a reasonably straightforward clinical scenario. I guess if you think that animal is normal, you need to consider the history. Is this dog truly presenting with a neurological condition, or is it something else? Abdominal pain, joint pain? Is it that the dog has popped both cruciates or one cruciate? So it's very important to just go back and see if there's any other systems involved. We will now start video one. So as that video fires up, when you're looking at abnormal patients, it's very, very easy in some cases. Owners are often quick to provide videos these days, and in this situation, we can see a four-year-old Labrador Retriever having a generalized seizure, and quite a severe one at that. In other patients, it gets a bit more challenging. This is similarly a Labrador Retriever. This guy was 11 years old, and his presenting problem was just this. So have a look at the video for a second. Doesn't look like the previous dog. This guy's just sitting there, minding his own business, having a look round. But to them, this was something that was markedly abnormal for this dog. This was completely out of character. To me, he looked just like a Labrador quietly sitting there. But once you get to know a bit about the history, it's very clear that for them, this dog's behavior was markedly out of character. And this guy had a frontal lobe meningioma. Now, as I said before, the abnormal ones are normally, fairly easy to spot. But if they truly look to be neurologically normal, it's always worth considering the history in detail and making sure that you ruled out problems with other body systems, for example, the orthopedic system. Sometimes it can be a metabolic condition. Other times there can be some evidence of trauma. Now, once you've determined if the patient is neurologically normal, abnormal, or abnormal, things become a little more challenging. We now need to try and determine, is that problem originating from the brain, the spinal cord, or the neuromuscular system? The brain can then be divided to provide a more precise neuroanatomical localization into the forebrain, the brainstem, or the cerebellum. The spinal cord into the spinal cord segments of C1, C5, and that stands for cervical 1 to cervical 5, cervical 6 to thoracic 2, thoracic 3 to lumbar 3, and lumbar 4 to sacral 3. And finally, the neuromuscular system, and that can be a combination or one of muscles, nerves, or the neuromuscular junction. And so we have, once you've determined it's abnormal, we actually have a relatively limited number of localizations for a neurological problem. And as I've said before, if you can't get beyond brain, spinal cord, or neuromuscular, which sometimes I can't, then actually that's fine. That's perfectly good to start to look at differential diagnoses and begin to make decisions on treatment or referral. Now, when we squeeze that down, we're left with what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 10 potential places where the lesion can occur. I'm going to bring in a bit of terminology now, and that's on upper and lower motor neurons. And for me, this terminology can sometimes be really confusing and actually sometimes not helpful for people trying to perform a neurological exam. But it's important just to get an understanding of these two terms. So, upper motor neurons, these are neurons that originate in the brain and they initiate and control actions. They're like these long wires that travel from the brain all the way down the spinal cord, right down to almost just above the hips. So they initiate control actions and they mainly have an inhibitory influence. I always think of them, like the stern parents or the managers of the system. They inhibit lower motor neurons. Now, lower motor neurons, these guys are critical in providing muscle tone and bearing weight. They also maintain reflex arcs. These are the little powerhouses of the neurological system. They are the motors. They're the electrical circuits that allow dogs to stand and move. Now, there are lower motor neurons scattered everywhere, from the brainstem all the way down the tip of the tail. But as in humans, there are two areas: the C6 to T2 spinal cord segments and the L4 to S3 spinal cord segments, where there's a huge cluster of these guys. And the reason is that we need those little motors, those lower motor neurons, to power the legs that keep these animals upright. So also important to remember that the vertebrae and vertebral segments are not perfectly aligned. The spinal cord stops growing a long, long while before the vertebral column does. And therefore, if we look at those L4, 5, and 6 segments, which I think I can get a little pointer up here, just in this area here, we can see that actually they're way up the vertebral column, right in the middle there, and some distance away from the hips. That's something that people often don't appreciate. A concise history is absolutely essential. You can probably determine the animal's presenting problem in 80% of cases from the history. And we use this five-finger rule, which takes into account the animal's signalment, the onset of the condition, the progression of the condition, are the clinical findings symmetrical and painful, and finally the localization to come up with a real sort of snapshot of the history. And when we combine that with this neuroanatomical localization, which we've got from our neurological examination, we can very quickly come up with a concise and concentrated differential diagnosis list. I'm quickly going to do a little bit on the five-finger rule. It does provide a concise summary to aid clinical reasoning. You can use this in multiple sort of disease areas, but for neurology, it's absolutely invaluable. So, for example, if we look at signalment in just dogs with spinal disease, we can see along the bottom here, we move from small dogs up to larger dogs. And on the y-axis, we move from younger dogs to older dogs. Rule of thumb: inflammatory conditions, malformations, or congenital disorders are more likely to occur in younger, smaller dogs. Something like a disc extrusion, medium size, middle age. Something like lumbar sacral disease or a cervical spondylomyelopathy, these tend to be the older, larger breeds. There's always variations, but in general, we can pop them in those category. And then obviously things like cancers, they also tend to affect the older, larger breeds. In the middle there, also in these kind of medium-sized, middle-aged dogs, we have things like ischemic myelopathies, which is a fibrocartilaginous embolism, and this acronym here, which is high velocity, low volume intervertebral disc extrusion. So take what you will for this, but you know, it's important to consider the signalment. Cancers are more likely to occur in older dogs, congenital malformations more likely to occur in younger, and then you've got everything in between. If we look at onset, we'll quickly go through this. There's a huge number of abbreviations on the bottom, but we'll just go through a couple of them. So this is from a study I did a couple of years ago, looking at the days to presentation for dogs with spinal disease. And as you'd expect, things like an ischemic myelopathy, an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion, two diseases where little bits of disc either block a vessel or hit the cord, they occur almost instantly. A disc extrusion occurs over a matter of 1, 2, 3 days. Inflammatory conditions, days to a couple of weeks. And then over the other end, we've got things like degenerative myelopathy, neoplasms, spinal arachnoid diverticulum, congenital and cancerous conditions logically are going to take longer to progress, and therefore those animals are going to take longer to present. So it's just a quick snapshot on what we're dealing with. So those are two examples to show just how important the five-finger rule of signalment, onset, progression, symmetry, and pain is, and we'll come back to that later. So we're now going to move on to actually performing the neurological examination. Each neurological exam has seven key steps. Now you might be saying, well, there's eight there, but we know that to check deep pain perception is only essential in a small proportion of spinal diseases. So let's go from the top. We've got mentation, we've got posture, we've got gait, we've got postural reactions, we've got spinal reflexes, cranial nerves, and then palpation of the vertebral column. Start with number one, mentation. Mentation is divided into two sort of key areas. The first is the level of mentation, and the second is the quality of mentation. And the level of mentation is determined by the ascending reticular activating system. This is a network of fibers that comes from all the way down the base of the spinal cord, heads up into the brainstem. It's a really primitive network of fibers. It responds to light, which is transmitted by the pineal gland and gets us awake in the morning and keeps us conscious throughout the day, and seems to be particularly active in my 13-week-old baby at present. So that's the level of mentation. And we have four levels. One is normal, one second is obtunded, third is stuporous, and the fourth is comatose. Now, this is Joe Belch, a nice old boxer dog who had a meningioma just affecting his balance system. But you can see that Joe's mentation, despite his disease, is normal. He's a bright dog, he's interacting with his owners. You know, he's looking around at his environment, and it is fully compos mentis. If we compare that to the Labrador retriever that we saw at the start of the presentation, this guy is definitely obtunded. He is not as bright as he normally is. He's not responding to sort of stimuli in his environment or verbal commands from his owner. He looks like a dog that is on the verge of sleep, or, you know, overly relaxed, as it were. So this is an obtunded dog. There's a picture of a cat there. There used to be a video attached to it, but this cat potentially was just staring in the side of the room, completely unresponsive to stimuli, able to walk around, still conscious, but clearly abnormal mentation. Let's move on to the next section on mentation. And these two involve when the animal is unconscious. This was a Doberman that presented with quite severe lungworm affecting its brain. It was an unconscious animal. And we know that there are two types of mentation which can cause unconsciousness, and these are a stupor or a coma. And the way to differentiate between those is unfortunately reasonably straightforward, but quite brutal. A stuporous animal If I use forceps and apply a noxious stimulus to the digits, these animals will wake up and rouse. They'll at least lift their heads or open their eyes. Whereas an animal that is comatose will not respond to a noxious stimulus. Now, I have to say that in either of these settings, the prognosis for either a stuprous animal or a comatose animal is pretty guarded, okay? And we need to be aware of that. We now come on to quality of mentation. Quality of mentation is determined by the forebrain. It allows us to take in things in our environment. It's the kind of processing system for all our senses, and it allows us to make conscious decisions based on what we are perceiving. Here we have video 5 and video 6 of two animals with abnormal mentation. So I'll start playing of this little Westie. So this Westie initially, when it came in the consult room, and this was when I was back at the RVC, interactive, looking in the mop bucket, but then all of a sudden starts backing it around. You can't hear this on the video, vocalizing, very, very distressed. The quality of this animal's mentation in that instant has changed from being normal to very, very abnormal. So I'll leave that running and we'll play video 6. This is a Staffordshire Bull Terrier sent video sent in by the owner. This dog is walking, but the level of men sorry, the quality of mentation is clearly normal, abnormal. We started with some staring in the corner. We've now got some compulsive pacing around the room. The owner is trying to get the dog's attention in the background, but the dog still has this sort of compulsive pace, and then off into the corner of the room for another bout of sort of staring and almost head pressing. So these two animals had marked forebrain disease. The Westie was an inflammatory brain disease, and unfortunately, the Staffy was a brain tumour. But those owners describe their animals as a bit odd. So we now come on to posture. This is actually quite challenging and often confuses students, residents, and clinicians alike. The three postures we're going to talk about are a decerebrate posture, a decerebellate posture, and then I'll throw in a bit at the end about a Schiff-Sherrington posture. So this is an animal that has opisthotonus, which means its head is extended back, its legs are stiff, its neck muscles are stiff, and its pelvic limbs are quite flaccid and atonic. And believe it or not, this is a characteristic of both decerebrate and decerebellate postures. Now, the way to differentiate between the two is to, again, think about consciousness. We assess the level of consciousness because an animal that is decerebrate will be unconscious and unresponsive, whereas an animal that is decerebellate will be conscious. And the reason for that is reasonably straightforward. In a decerebrate animal, it kind of does what it says on the tin. These animals have a functional disconnect between their brainstem and their forebrain. It's a unconscious damaged forebrain attached to the rest of the animal, so the instructions are not getting through. We compare that to an animal with a decerebellate posture, much more straightforward. This is just where the cerebellum has been affected, so there might be some changes in balance, posture, tone, but these animals, if you call them, will lift their head and are easily rousable. I did say I'd put something in about Schiff-Sherrington posture. It can look almost the same as a decerebellate and a decerebrate posture, particularly you've got these extended hypotonic thoracic limbs and the slightly flaccid pelvic limbs. But this animal has no abnormal tone in the neck. They're always conscious. And the rest of the neuro exam will reveal that they normally have an acute onset and reasonably severe T3L3 myelopathy, okay, so a spinal cord injury. Schiff-Sherrington posture is no indicator of prognosis. All it tells you is you've got a thoracolumbar spinal cord lesion. Other things we're looking at in posture are for head turn. Now, when you're looking at this, you can see that this dog has a head turn to the left. But those of you who are really watching carefully will see that it's also got its right paw turned over. If we think about that sensory information coming up the sensory pathways, crossing over to the left side of the forebrain, This animal has a left-sided forebrain lesion. That's a beautiful photo. And then we have a head tilt, which is nicely shown here by this little Siamese cat. So the head turn is most often due to forebrain lesions, and the head tilt is most often due to the vestibular system, but it can result from disorders of the cerebellum and actually can also result from some disorders of the thalamus. But for today's work, let's think about these as forebrain and vestibular system. This is a patient that I've actually seen twice who's popped two discs in his neck. This is a little Frenchie called Sarge, and he would sit in this posture for hours prior to referral because of the marked neck pain. So he almost adopts this praying position. And this cat on the other side has ventriflexion of the necks. Neck muscles are almost flaccid and floppy, and its head looks down. So these are two very characteristic presentations. The one on the left with Sarge the Frenchie is due to neck pain. The one on the right is this amazing list of differentials that we always get quizzed on. Some of these can be metabolic, for example, potassium deficiency. Some can be nutritional, for example, thiamine deficiency. And then there's all sorts of infectious, inflammatory, toxic causes. But if your cat has a ventriflexion of the neck, there's almost always a clear and well-defined reason for that affected musculature in the neck. So we're still on posture. In this animal on the left, we have a wide-based stance. You can see that both the thoracic limbs and the pelvic limbs are braced to keep this animal upright. And if we look at video 7, very sort of classic signs. This poor little dog is desperate to eat that bit of chicken, but because of the loss of control and the abnormalities in controlling the rate, range, and force of motion, he just can't get to it. And in each case, these wide-based stance and attention tremor are caused by lesions in the cerebellum. Okay. We're now on to gait. Gait's a really good one, and we would always advocate taking animals outside, getting videos from owners, or letting them off the lead in the consult just so you can get an assessment of how these guys are doing. This is a dog that came from Romania. He had been owned by its current owner for 2 months, and at no point was she aware that this dog was less responsive to her. She put it down to language difficulties. She also failed to notice that this dog would exclusively circle to the left. Now, I have to say that this is towards the sort of more severe end of its presentation. But this guy here is doing very wild, wide, compulsive circles. If we contrast that between this little guy, he is doing similarly very tight circles, and also you can notice that he also has a little head tilt as well. Now, the causes for these lesions again, the left sided. Sorry, the wide left focus circles is due to a forebrain lesion, and the tight circles are often due to the vestibular system. But I would caution again, the thalamus, that integrating center of the brain, this processing center, can cause weird clinical signs. So don't just think it's vestibular system unless you've got other sort of cardinal signs. We're now going to move on to two terms that describe gait. These terms are often easily confused. I'm going to try and be precise in defining them. The first is ataxia. In the simplest of words, this means a loss of axis. Okay, the dog simply cannot walk in a straight line, and the reason being is that they have an inability to perform coordinated motor function. They cannot get their legs in the place that they want them to be. They are off balance, they are wobbly, their legs will cross, the strides are uneven, and this is due to a disruption of sensory input. So ataxia, remember that phrase, a loss of axis, says it in the word, and it's due to disruption of sensory input. There are actually three types of ataxia, and we'll start to pull up the videos for these. The first one is a vestibular ataxia, so a disruption of the balance system. This again is a video I took at the RVC. You can see there as that cat staggers, the ataxia, the wide-based stance, the crouched pelvic limbs as it's trying to steady itself. And then as it turns around, you can see that uncertain positioning of the limbs and that really, really severe head tilt to the right. So this is a very classic vestibular ataxia. Video 11, brilliant video for this dog. This is a dog that, as you see it walk, it cannot control its rate, range, and force of movement. It's very dysmetric, which means its legs are all over the place. Doesn't have a head tilt, doesn't have a head turn, but its legs are all over the shop. And this is a guy with a cerebellar ataxia, which is due to, in this case, it was a toxicity. This dog was actually absolutely fine 2 days later. And then last but not least, let's get video 12 up, which we'll play now. Again, a little French bulldog. And when you look at those pelvic limbs, okay, as he turns around, the front legs are normal, but those pelvic limbs, they're wide base, they're crossing over, the stride length is uneven, he's unsteady on his feet. This is a classic ataxia, a general proprioceptive ataxia, because this guy had slipped a disc in his back, and the signals coming from those back legs are not getting effectively up to the brain. The second term we use is called paresis. Much more complex term, I think, to try and explain. This, in the broadest sense, is an inability to bear weight, okay? But also, it's an inability to generate gait. So these animals, for one reason or another, won't be able to support themselves properly, and they also won't be able to walk properly. And it always results in a loss of voluntary movement to some extent. And this is a disruption of motor input. The signals coming from the brain, trying to get to the legs, and trigger those muscles and those little neuronal circuits to generate gait, they're just not getting through there. So paresis is an inability to bear weight and an inability to generate gait. Now, there are two types of paresis, just to confuse things. You can get a lower motor neuron paresis, and if you think if we had a lesion in the L4-S1 spinal cord segments, we're going to shut down those motors. We're going to shut down those motor neurons. The tone's going to go, the reflexes are going to go, the muscle mass will decrease. It's like pulling a plug out of a socket, and therefore we get a flaccid paresis. If I had a lesion in the T3 to L3 spinal cord segments, this would result in an upper motor neuron paresis or a spastic paresis. The reason being is if you remember what I said, these upper motor neurons are the managers, the parents, they're sending down inhibitory signals from the spinal cord. If I have a lesion here, these legs have got no control. They're going to go into their default position, which is like leg stiff and undercarriage down. Now, paresis can be divided further into a mono, a hemi, a para, or a tetraparesis, and we're going to have a look at those, I think, in a second. It can also progress from a paresis, which is limited movement, to a plesia, which is absolutely no movement at all. Okay, and it's important to get the differentiation between those terms. Let's look at video 13, 14, and 15. Poor old Daisy will be working to get these up. So here we are, video 13. This is a staffy that had fibrocartilage embolism or an ischemic myelopathy, to use the correct terminology. And as it turns around, you can see very clearly that the right pelvic limb is not able to bear weight and it's not able to generate gait. It's a paretic limb, so that's a monoparesis. Video 14, a lovely border collie that presented with the same injury. A fibrocartilage embolism. In this situation, we've got the same problem with both pelvic limbs, so we have a paraparesis. Both are affected. And finally, this little guy who had a neck lesion. This video is supplied by my old colleague, Yasser Beltran. You can see that this guy doesn't really have any visible movement in either the thoracic limbs or the pelvic limbs. He has a tetraparesis. Now, paresis rarely occurs without ataxia, and I show you this diagram, which used to haunt my dreams when I was studying for boards, but it gives a really good understanding of why these two are rarely exclusive. So in the green, we can see the descending tracts, the motor tracts, mainly concentrated in the ventral aspect of the cord, And on the left side, we've got the red tracks, the ascending tracks or the sensory tracks. And you can see that those are mainly in the dorsal elements in the spinal cord. Now, if I put a huge disc extrusion at this level, compressing the ventral aspect of the spinal cord and pushing the top onto the vertebral canal, you can see that I'm never just going to get a paresis or an ataxia. I'm always going to have both. Okay, so invariably, if something's ataxic, it will be paretic. Before we go any further, and everyone laughs at this dreadful diagram, but in the pressure of the consult room, and I still have a sketch of this in my notebook, a post-it note on the back of the computer. Always remember the box dog. You're trying to break things down into the brain, the spinal cord segments, or the spinal cord, of which C6 and T2 contain these bulky, big clusters of lower motor neurons, and L4, S3, those big clusters of lower motor neurons, or the little stick-like legs, the neuromuscular system coming out. It takes 10 seconds to draw, but it may help you crystallize your thinking. So we're now going to look at postural reactions. We're down onto number four in the neuro exam. And what we're testing here is proprioception, the sense of the position of the body and the limbs, essentially knowing where your limbs are in relation to your body. And we're testing sensory pathways from the extremities to the brain. In this diagram, we can see that the clinician is supporting the dog under the belly, turning over that limb. And if sensory information is going up the box dog through the peripheral nerves, through the spinal cord segments, up to the brain, we should get the dog turning over its paw pretty quickly. We have some examples of paw positioning here. In big dogs, we tend to hold the animals under their belly. Just under the hips, it's important to support as much of their weight as you can because we want to try and isolate this sensory information coming from the foot. In this situation, this is a small dog. If you hold it under its belly, it thinks you're going to pick it up. I know that because this is my dog. And so what we do is tend to hold it under the bum, under the haunches there. And you steady the dog, make sure it's nice and steady. Use a non-slip surface, turn that paw over, and almost in the blink of an eye, a click of a fingers, this paw should turn up over because the sensory information is coming up the peripheral nerve through the spinal cord segments, decussating in the thalamus and heading off into the right side of the brain. So paw positioning you must always do. Hopping you should always do. Hopping will test your proprioceptive inputs, but in this situation, rather than just testing the sort of sensory information coming up that leg, we're also taking input from these joint proprioceptors, from the vestibular system, from the cerebellum. So it's a bit more of a rough and ready test, but you should still do it. Now, in this situation, the dog is held upright. You try and isolate the leg that you want to test, and then you hop in this direction. So you move off the center line, push the dog over this way, and almost immediately we should see a little hop of that leg. If we're coming back the other way, we would isolate the right pelvic limb and hop in the direction of the leg that you're testing. Now, other people will do wheelbarrowing, extensor postural thrusts. Sometimes we do those in cats, but really you're looking at sort of paw positioning and hopping as your staples of postural reactions. We're then going to move on to testing spinal reflexes. The only reason you are testing spinal reflex is to determine if you have a lesion in areas where there are large clusters of lower motor neurons. So that's the C6 to T2 spinal cord segments, the L4 to S3 spinal cord segments. You want to be looking at tone, at muscle mass, and at the reflexes themselves. And I'm not that worried about whether they're hyperreflexive, hyporeflexive. I just want to know, is there a reflex present, which means that these motors are working, or is it absent, which means they're broken and affected? The spinal reflexes that we test are divided into two broad camps. We have the withdrawal reflexes over this side, the ones on the thoracic limb and the pelvic limbs, and they test all muscles and nerves in those big sort of clusters down at that end. And then we have the tendon reflexes, which were very, very specific, and they isolate specific nerves and specific spinal cord segments. And in the thoracic limb, they are the biceps reflex, the triceps reflex, and you can do the extensor carpi radialis. In the pelvic limb, you have the patella, the gastrocnemius, and the peroneal. Now, there are a lot of reflexes to test. You're going to be, hammering away, and it's going to take a long, long while. Truthfully, what do I always test? I always test the withdrawal. It's a very rough, ready, but fast and effective way of testing the C6 to T2 spinal cord segments and the L4 to S1. I'll also have a go at the biceps and triceps, definitely the patella, and then I also, particularly in animals with a floppy tail or lumbar sacral disease or pelvic limb abnormalities, I always check the peroneal reflex as well. Okay, so this shouldn't take too long in a neuro exam. Everyone can lie a dog on its side, pull on the thoracic limb, pull on the pelvic limb, and potentially, if you have the equipment and the confidence to do it, you can also test some tendon reflexes. But remember, the only reason you're doing this is to determine is there a lesion in the C6 to T2 spinal cord segments or L4 to S3. Nothing more fancy than that. Here are a couple of images of those reflexes being done. For the biceps reflex, the biceps tendon is gripped just in the crook of the elbow. The arm is the leg. Sorry, I thought it was a small child. The leg is pulled back to expose the biceps brachialis, and the finger is struck with the patella hammer, and you'll see a little flick of the biceps muscle, and very often as well, that leg will jump. Similarly, with the triceps, you expose the triceps tendon, you make sure there's a decent amount of flexion in the elbow so that tendon is taut, and then you strike the tendon, and you'll see a little flicker of the triceps. Patella is a really easy one to do. Everyone can do this. Animal on its side. The knee or stifles slightly flex to get some tension on that patella tendon, and then you lightly strike it with a patella hammer, and you'll be able to see that beautiful reflex kicking in your hand. And this is just a testing of the withdrawal. You don't use a noxious stimulus, you use digital pressure. You put it, apply it to either the thoracic or the pelvic limbs, and we should get a nice withdrawal reflex. Video 16, I might have to speed up a bit here so you can all get your lunch. But this is the cutaneous truncus reflex, an amazing reflex that should always be carried out. Here we use a noxious stimulus, we apply it to the skin. You'll see that. This dog has had a hemilaminectomy. I'm going to see if we can play this again. And you'll note that when we start, let's see if I can play that again. Here we go. So when we start, we're just at the caudal aspect of the surgical site, and you get this cutaneous truncus reflex. However, when you do it more caudally, we do not get that cutaneous truncus reflex. And the reason is quite straightforward. The sensory input comes up from the stimulus through the spinal cord, comes out of this lateral thoracic nerve, and causes muscular contraction. If we have a lesion, so an extruded disc, for example, that information is not going to get past. It's not going to reach that junction box to make that muscle contract. But if I jump above the affected piece of spinal cord, all of a sudden that lesion comes back. So it's an amazingly accurate way of identifying spinal cord lesions. We're now going to move on to the cranial nerves, and this is a reasonably basic and quick version. Okay, we know that there are 12 cranial nerves. They move from cranial nerve 1 in the rostral aspect of the head all the way back to cranial nerve 12, the hypoglossal nerve, way, way, way back at almost at the base of the brainstem. It's really fascinating. If we plot these on the brain, we can see that everything pretty much from cranial nerve 5 is way tucked back in the brainstem, so almost exiting the skull. At the very, very back of the skull. And it's only really the olfactory, the optic, the oculomotor, and the trochlea that are actually in the part of the brain where we might expect them to be. When you look at that laterally, beautifully illustrates that there's a few chucked out the front, but the vast majority of them are way, way back in the brainstem, all grouped together, tucked under the cerebellum. Now, you've got 12 cranial nerves, but honestly, which ones are you going to test? Not that many. And you can kind of divide them into those groups that are centered around the eyes and responses driven by vision. We can also look at facial asymmetry and facial sensation. That's a useful exercise. And then we move further back, looking at disorders of the balance system, and then the really, really caudal cranial nerves, those associated with the gag reflex. And when we map the cranial nerves that we're actually testing onto these different tests, we can see that with a menace response, the sensory information comes through the optic nerve from the eye, and then the eyelids will blink with the motor input of cranial nerve 7. The pupillary light reflex, and it is a reflex again through the fibers of the optic nerve, and then it's the parasympathetic fibers of the ocular motor nerve that constrict and that pupil. Facial asymmetry is beautiful, and we'll have a look at this in a second. Very straightforward, all down to cranial nerve 7. Facial sensation, again, reasonably straightforward. If I tickle your face, you're going to sense it through cranial nerve 5, and your response that your face gives, so that grimacing, that curling the lip away, is going to be driven by the facial nerve. The vestibular ocular reflex, which we'll talk about in a second, the input comes through the vestibular cochlear nerve, which is number 8. And then that drives the movement of the eyes, which immediately the oculomotor nerve, number 3, and then laterally we have cranial nerve 6, the abducens. Gag reflex is really straightforward, always 9 and 10. So if you take your hand, your fingers, and put it down the back of the dog's tongue, you should get this swallow or gag reflex, 9 and 10. The same cranial nerves that might account for a change in bark or a difficulty swallowing food. So those are the ones that I test: menace response, pupillary light reflex, facial asymmetry, facial sensation, vestibular ocular reflex, and gag reflex. We'll have a quick look at those on video 17. So this is the menace response. The pathway for the menace response is hugely complex, but all you want to be asking yourself is that when you hide one eye and use a menacing gesture against the other one without touching whiskers or blowing wind at the cornea, does the dog blink? Does it have a menace response? Because then you know that there's sensory information coming in through cranial nerve 2, and there's motor information coming out of cranial nerve 7. Happy days. Don't worry about the bits in between. Just 2 in, 7 out. This little guy I had to get off the internet because it's almost impossible to video, but this is the pupillary light reflex. You are shining a decent quality light. So I see people using iPhones, they're not too bad, but those old pen torches that are given as free giveaways with the kind of insipid yellow light on them, no, it's not worth it. You need a decent light to get a decent response. And we can see here, and I'll play this a couple of times, that as the light is shone directly into the dog's eye, we get this beautiful constriction of the pupil. You see it really nicely there. And similarly, if we flick the light back over to the opposite eye, we should also see a contralateral response, okay? Or a consensual response in that eye because some of the fibers have crossed over and have sent information to the eye on the other side. Because if I have a pair of car headlights driving at me late at night, it's no good if one eye responds and the other one does nothing. I want to shut that light out as effectively as possible. Facial sensation. I'm not sure it's the most useful diagram, but the gist we're trying to give you here is that the trigeminal nerve is made of three branches: the ophthalmic branch, the maxillary branch, and the mandibular branch. And sometimes if I have, students, I actually get three fingers, I put them up on the side of my face, almost like a Dr. Spock gesture, and that gives you a good indication of where these branches go, because the ophthalmic branch is kind of the medial aspect, and if you touch the medial canthus of the eye, you should get a nice blink. The maxillary branch is the lateral aspect and the sensation of the upper lip and nose. And I always touch the upper lip just where that canine tooth comes, and that will elicit a nice sort of flicker of that face, a wrinkling of the face. And similarly, for the mandibular portion, use the canines as your reference point. Touch that portion of the jaw. Sometimes they'll try and move out of your hand, they might wrinkle a lip. It's more difficult with this one because the response is not as profound, but those are the sort of autonomous zones here, here, and here for testing the ophthalmic, the maxillary, and the mandibular portions of the cranial nerve. Let's see if we can get this video up and running. This is a great video. This is the facial nerve, and it shows all the facial muscles that actually are powered by that nerve. If you look closely, you can see that potentially the facial movement on the right side is affected. We can see that there's no nares movement. We can see that the jaw is the face is potentially drooped on that side. We can see that the eye doesn't blink. And actually, if you also saw the dog in real life, you realize that the ears, or certainly a portion of the muscles around the ear, was not working too. We'll play that once more. So look at the nares, the eye, and the facial muscles on the right-hand side. And it gives you a good indication of just how severe the changes can be when that facial nerve's affected. So that's the facial nerve. And the vestibulo-ocular reflex. This is the equivalent of you. Everyone tells you when you're sat on a train or you're in a car and you focus on an object, your eyes will be directed by your vestibular system, and your head will be directed by your vestibular system to look at that object for as long as you want to. But then there comes a point when the eyes have to flick back to their natural direction. And so in this situation, it's very difficult to video, but this is a dog, and we're trying to demonstrate that normal vestibulo-ocular reflex. So as the dog's head moves through the field of vision, you'll occasionally see these eyes flicker back to their normal position. Yeah, just there. And what's happening is that the vestibular system is sending inputs via the brainstem up into the brain, and the motor output via the oculomotor and the abducens nerve is helping keep those eyes level and track with the head. Okay, and if this is the balance system is affected, as well as seeing a head tilt, as well as seeing a vestibular ataxia, we're also likely to see the vestibulo-ocular reflex reduced in the direction of the lesion, so the eyes get left behind. They're literally just dragging along as you turn that head. Nearly there. Last but not least, palpation, okay? Which we tend to palpate all the way down and back up the vertebral column. But when you're doing that, it's important to consider which structures actually have no nociceptors in them, so which can detect pain. And you'd be amazed that actually pretty much everything, the ligaments, the disc, the bones, the nerves, the meninges, the joints can all have the ability to detect pain. The only thing that does not is the spinal cord itself. And that's why some lesions, like an ischemic myelopathy, like an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion, some cancers, are non-painful because it's just the tissue of the cord that's been affected. Whereas others, like a disc extrusion, which might be pressing, which might have damaged the disc, be pressing on the meninges, rupture the dorsal longitudinal ligament, and be pressing on a nerve, are likely to be screamingly painful. So it's important to think, you know, what conditions are painful, what conditions aren't painful, and where is that pain stimulus originating from? Last but not least, we're going to talk about nociception. Actually, just let me go back. So when I palpate the vertebral column, I go down the vertebral column, pressing on the spinous processes, okay? Either on them or in between them. And then when I come back up, I move my fingers slightly wider and I press on the articular processes as well. And then I might also give a little squeeze out wider just to make sure that if there's any nerve root pain, any radicular pain, and we've got sensitive muscles, and feeling if there's any trigger points there. So don't just do it once, go down, back up, and then have another look again if you think there's some sensitive points. So nociception or deep pain perception. This is only relevant in animals that are monoplegic or paraplegic with severe spinal cord or nerve injuries. So if this animal has absolutely no witness voluntary movement, that's when you need to test for deep pain perception, because its prognosis will be determined by if it has any functional pathway left to detect those nociceptive stimuli. Now, it's really important that you use a noxious stimulus. No point doing it with your thumb and finger, no point doing it with your fingernails. This test is the single determinant of whether this animal, for example, might be referred, might be treated, might be euthanized. So it's best to do it properly. And what we do is we take a set of forceps, we apply them to the periosteum, and I always do the medial and lateral digits because one's innervated by the femoral nerve, one by the sciatic, and unfortunately, you crunch them because you want to see if there genuinely is a conscious response. And that conscious response is vocalizing, head turn, changing facial expression, and actually trying to bite you. And I know it can be upsetting for the owner to see this done, or sometimes upsetting for the nurses, but this is the single biggest determinant of sort of prognosis in these animals. It's also important to understand that withdrawal does not indicate the presence of nociception, okay? So withdrawal is just a local reflex art, and actually, if this dog unfortunately was dead but still had some ATP in him, I can get a pretty decent reflex art. So withdrawal does not indicate it. I unfortunately need this guy to cry out, turn his head, change his face, or try and nip me. So it's a really, really important test that should only be used in certain circumstances. So to summarize, before we do a couple of cases, each neurology consult has three key questions. My goodness, like tongue twister to answer. Is the animal neurologically normal or abnormal? Is it the brain, the spinal cord, or neuromuscular system affected? And what is the neuroanatomical localization? Neurologically normal or abnormal? Brain, spinal cord, neuromuscular, neuroanatomical localization. And as I say all the time, even if you can do this one, then actually that's good enough. These two and a decent history, and you're well on the way to identifying where the problem is and what the condition might be. We're going to do some cases. These are reasonably straightforward, but it gives you an idea of how my mind works when I approach cases, which might not be a good thing. So this is case one, 4-year female spayed miniature Dachshund who was called Daisy. She's always been bouncy and happy. She was reluctant to walk yesterday. She cried out when picked up, and she was wobbly before bed. Today, she is unable to walk. So, from this history, we've got a huge amount of information. Neurologically normal before, something started 24 hours ago. It's now painful. She was obviously ataxic, and now it's progressed to some level of paresis. So that capsule history tells us a great amount. Oh, and she didn't eat her dinner, which is might be due to the pain. So here's video 21 and video 22. This is little Daisy who we saw at the RVC. So here she is. Not the best video, but ask yourself, neurologically normal or abnormal? Definitely abnormal. Which legs are affected? Definitely the back legs. And we can see that she is crossing those legs, isn't she? She's not able to bear weight properly. So this is a dog who is ataxic and also paraparetic, but she has some voluntary movement. Video 22. Here you can see supporting the individual under the belly. The paws are being turned over, and there is no righting response there, okay? Either on the left pelvic limb or the right. Or the right. So proprioception is abnormal. Now, if I describe the full neurological exam, we have mentation, bright and alert, posture, moderate kyphosis. We could see that in the video. This young lady has an ambulatory, so she's still able to just get up and about, paraparesis. Back legs affected, she's still got some movement. And she definitely has a pelvic limb ataxia. The pelvic in poor position in hopping was absent. The spinal reflexes were normal. And she had a clear cutaneous truncate cutoff at T11. And she had thoracic lumbar pain. So before you go any further, stick to the questions, okay? Was this animal neurologically normal or abnormal? Well, we know clearly that she's abnormal. Do we think it's brain, spinal cord, or neuromuscular system? We definitely think it's spinal cord. And then last but not least, which spinal cord segments? Well, we know it's just the back leg, so it's either T3 or L3 or L4, S3. And we know here that we have spinal reflexes, so it's a T3, L3 myelopathy. From our history, you may not be able to see this. We've got a middle-aged chondrodystrophic dog, acute onset, deteriorating, very symmetrical, very painful T3, L3 myelopathy. So let's put that together with our neuro exam and come up with some differential diagnoses. Intervertebral disc extrusion, probably one, and truthfully, 1 to 10, I should think. But then other things you could consider are an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion or an FCE. Last but not least, we'd probably put in there a neoplasm or a meningomyelitis. But realistically, until proven otherwise, this little dog has a disc. And we can see that quite clearly here on the MRI. She has a nice intervertebral disc extrusion. I think that's T12, T13. And you can see that little hypo intense blob there pressing on the spinal cord. We decompressed Daisy with a hemilaminectomy and pretty quickly with video 23 and video 24, she was able to get up and about. I think this was the day after, and already look, she's looking better. Okay, still ataxic, still parapretic, but the poor positioning has come back, which shows you how quickly in the right hands these guys can recover. Look, a tail wag too. I think this is the last case, so we're nearly done. This is case two. A 5-year female spayed Staffordshire Bull Terrier called Safi. She was out running for the ball, and immediately, click of her fingers, she suddenly collapsed. She was immediately, as the owner described it, off her back legs. She wasn't able to use them. She's now ambulatory. She never seemed painful, and her right leg is worse than the left. So this is our capsule history. It's a per-acute onset. Almost immediately, she's clearly lost the use of her pelvic limbs. The front legs seem normal. She's now improving, which is great. We've got some lateralization. The right leg is worse than the left, and she's never seemed painful. So there's a lot of information in there that we can use. So let's have a look at some elements of her neuro exam. So video 25, this is her walking. Beautiful. Very lateralized neurological signs. The left pelvic limb seems just fine, but that right pelvic limb is extremely paretic. She's not able to bear weight or generate gait in it, so she has a monoparesis. When we look at her tone and her poor positioning, her tone is incredibly flaccid. Her muscles are flaccid, and so this should start to point you towards which potentially spinal cord segments are affected. Now, she actually had no patellar reflex, she had no withdrawal reflex. So, concerned about how she was doing here, we really tried to assess whether this withdrawal reflex was present. And you can see that we apply quite some force with our fingers, and eventually those signals get through, and she's pretty angry, but there was no withdrawal whatsoever. Okay, so we've got no tone and no withdrawal. Let's have a look at that once again. Our leg's not moving, is it? It's just staying flaccid. So here's the full neuro exam. Mentation, bright and alert. Posture, normal. Gait, ambulatory paraparesis with the pelvic limb ataxia, which is much, much, much worse on the right. The poor positioning and hopping were, oh, they were maybe a little bit reduced on the left, but they were absolutely absent on the right. Spinal reflexes, absent withdrawal and absent patella reflex on the right, and the limb tone was rubbish. And palpation, she wasn't painful in any way. So let's quickly flick over. Neurologically abnormal, definitely. Spinal cord, neuromuscular system, or brain. Well, our mentation's good. She has spinal reflexes in the other leg, so it's unlikely to be a neuromuscular system. But she does have obvious proprioceptive deficits and withdrawal deficits as well. So we know that she's spinal cord, and logic dictates because of those absence of spinal reflexes, it's got to be an L4S3 myelopathy. Our five-finger rule. We've got a middle-aged, medium-sized dog. It's a per-acute onset. It's improving, which is great news. It's asymmetrical and it's non-painful. It's also an L4S3 myelopathy. So our differential diagnosis for me, when we look at this dog, are a fibrocartilaginous embolism or an ischemic myelopathy, whichever term you prefer, an acute non-compressive nucleus pulposus extrusion, almost the same thing, but in this case, where the material goes into a vessel and causes an embolus. In this case, it shoots into the spinal cord and causes contusion and bleeding. And then, last but not least, maybe an intervertebral disc extrusion, but truthfully, it doesn't quite fit. And sure enough, you may not be able to see it on here, but there's an area of hyperintensity in the cord, most consistent with an FCE, and that was slightly lateralized. And so this dog was diagnosed with an FCE and actually went on to recover within days and very, very well. So that is where we're at. Three questions: neurologically normal, abnormal, brain, spinal cord, neuromuscular system, and if you can, neuroanatomically localize. The one thing I would say to you guys is that if you can, practice on everything. Try your cats and dogs at home. You can try stuff that's been hospitalized, even if you just watch the way they walk and perhaps test some paw positioning and reflexes or even some cranial nerves. It's a really useful thing to do. Now, there are more detailed webinars that we also give at times on the neuromuscular system and also on the cranial nerves. But for today, those are two topics that are beyond the scope of this hour. So, thank you very much for listening. If any of you ever want to come and see practice with us, please give me a call and I'm happy to have you spend a day or week with us. And again, thank you for your patience and thank you for listening.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Tom for an excellent webinar today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.